did as a former police officer in, you know, changes, challenges, good and bad of law enforcement, you know, stories, you know, people that touch upon law enforcement, you know, like Nicole, for example. And I know, like, Leanna Perez, I met her in March, actually, at one of their symposiums, and you had her on, and or maybe I suggested you have her on, I'm not sure, but I met her, and I know a little bit about that organization, and I listened to your podcast about the lady who's in the pornography business. That was quite an interesting one.
Well, I think she was advocating for, I don't think she was a pornography business, I think she was just advocating for legalized or decriminalized sex work. So I don't want to put it out there she was in the porno business. Although I do want to have some porno stars on the show one day, but just
that would be a different channel. I think.
Yeah.
Maybe, but you know, the point is, there certainly is interaction between, you know, the porn industry and law enforcement. You know, it's not legal in every jurisdiction, and I think she was trying to legalize, I think, the sex industry. Basically, I think that was her motivation.
Yeah, that was her motivation. Yes.
Interesting show. And you know, I've listened to some of the other ones, but there's not that many, you know, podcasters, bloggers that are of interest to me, because my specific interest relates to officer-involved shootings, just to be honest with you, you know, officer-involved shootings.
Right.
And what happens to the family, what happens, you know, to the officers, legal aspects of an officer-involved shooting. That's my focus, Captain Hunter. That's really my focus.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I totally understand that. And I don't think that there's enough people talking out against it. I would say probably against it. The word against it is probably too harsh, but just trying to do a strict analysis of it and try to, you know, my goal is to really try to get the police to see the public's side and the public to see the police's side. And, you know, officers, we unfortunately developed this culture about us that really kind of, I mean, obviously we grow up in a society, and then at some point, you know, probably on graduation from the police academies, and subsequent getting away from your family, your friends, being indoctrinated into a lifestyle that says, okay, these people aren't your friends anymore. Essentially, that's what's going on. You have to be careful around them. And so that creates this wall. And you know, I think I had another, well, I definitely had another professor on, and he was talking about, you know, the sheepdog mentality, where the sheepdogs are protectors of the sheep, but eventually they develop this mindset where they don't think that they're sheep anymore, where they are, I'm here to protect you, and if you don't listen to me and you don't like me or you criticize me, then you're an asshole, or that you're a negative person who needs to be vanquished and brought into my protection because I know better. And this type of mentality, I think, is toxic. I think it's dangerous. It causes far too many more problems than we are, than society can bear, you know? And I think that persons like you are very important because it happened to you. Now, you know, obviously, just to give a brief story in history, you know, we all know, or many people do know, that law enforcement has been against or sheep herding, if you will, the Black community. So nobody had a problem when that was going on, when the lynchings were going on. When I say no one, I'm talking about the majority of middle class white Americans would say that there's no issues here, there's no problems here. If the Black community would stop doing X, Y, and Z, then these things wouldn't happen. Lo and behold, persons like yourself or another person that I interviewed, gosh, his name is slipping my mind, Michael Bell. Michael Bell, you know, good upstanding citizens. This happens to you, and all of a sudden, now it says, okay, well, there's a problem here. And I think that people have to wake up and say that there's a problem going on. Now, obviously, I'm former law enforcement, and you know, it's very controversial that I'm saying these types of things. I'm not saying that all law enforcement does this. All law enforcement has this mindset, but I think that there's a big problem when something does happen, and all of a sudden you see these cover-ups. All of a sudden you see people scrambling to protect people. One of the biggest problems with body cameras, and why a lot of people, I'm talking about reform type of groups, have a problem with body cam videos, is because if there's a body cam video of a police officer pulling a child out of a drowning water or something like that, then everyone hails him as a hero, and rightfully so. And the body cam footage is immediately put out. But if there's a shooting, oh, then we got to wait 2 years to see that video. And I think that, yes, that causes a big problem, and that causes the distrust. And so I think we have to be very transparent.
Transparency is an easy word, but it's a very wide subject.
Right.
And it's subject to a lot of, debate and, clarification. It's like the word reasonable.
Right.
As you know, being an officer, what the hell does reasonable mean?
Right.
It means something to something different to everyone.
Right.
Necessary. What is necessary, unnecessary? Yet, as you know, the attorneys craft those laws, and they're passed, and they're there. You know, what is reasonable? What is necessary? What is transparency? What is non-transparency? What's cooperation, non-cooperation? But you hit the nail on the head in your podcast, because you're simply pointing out that when the officers do something, I'll use a legal phrase, in a favorable light, then it's disclosed. When officers do something that does not show them in a favorable light, you can't get it. You can't get it out. You can't get the information. And that sows the seeds of distrust. And that has nothing to do with racism or, it's a trust issue.
Right.
And that's what you're saying. And I'm obviously an angry father. I am. I'm still traumatized. It's only been 30 months since my son was violent. I sent you the film, so I think you got a sense of how he was killed.
Yes, yes. I did watch all the videos that you sent me and read the DA's report and all that. Yeah.
And the DA, I didn't go into too great detail, but almost every single page, which I discovered through my diligence and my private investigator, which I had the money, I'm not super wealthy, but I had the money to hire, an attorney, a private investigator, and spend my time to unravel what the DA story was. And it's just full of absolute lies. And I will prove it if we ever get to court, but unfortunately, it's a long road from filing a lawsuit to a trial. And there's no guarantee I will even have a trial, as you know. I can be summary judgment. I could be, suffer summary judgment, and that could dismiss the case, or I will appeal, and because I have the money to appeal, but most people don't. Many of the victims don't have, just simply don't have the money, to put up a case, a lawsuit, against law enforcement, which has unlimited tax dollars, to fight.
Right.
To fight the victim. So I'm very focused on obviously getting justice for my son, who was a good kid, a good person, and to blow apart this story from the DA and the officers that just frankly thought they could get away, with the killing, and that no one would be behind that deceased person that would have any, substantial assets, and I do, and as did that fellow that you mentioned, who was a pilot, and an officer and a pilot and a successful family man, and to have his son killed, it's very similar type of reaction that I had.
Right.
It didn't make any sense, and the DA, instead of making sense, Lawrence, he just pulled from whole cloth any facts that he thought would really bully my wife and I into backing off. everything from suicide by cop to our son lied to us about mental health. This DA just pulled out of the air anything he could to bully us. And it was offensive. It's just horrible. But that's what he did.
Right, right. So we kind of jumped into it here. So why don't you explain to the audience the facts and the circumstances surrounding your son Tyler's death.
I'm glad you asked me the question. We'll just start from the beginning. My son, Tyler is his name, T-Y-L-E-R, Scott Rushing. And Tyler was 34 years old. He was not a child and a young man. And he did several things in his life. He had a home in Ventura, California, where my wife and I live and where Tyler lived his own home. It's a condominium that he had in Ventura. And he had several businesses, basically was self-employed. He was, for 10 years, he'd had a commercial and residential window cleaning business. And the window cleaning included ladder work. So he did a lot of difficult commercial and residential, you know, 2 and 3 story homes, things where a homeowner would not want to get up and clean their windows and screens. So, and he worked also for my management company. I'm a real estate broker and I have a property management company. So when I could get him, he was so busy, but when he was available, I'd have him work for me doing the same thing, working on buildings and helping me run the company even when I was gone. But his love was the arts and music. And he had been working music festivals and art festivals in the Western United States, things like Burning Man, which many people have heard of. He was with a group of artists that would go to Burning Man. He worked music festivals and he was a photographer in the making. His goal was to take photographs of these artists and performers behind the scenes with their permission and sell these images through his Instagram site. And was called Tiger Eye Photography. And he had it set up. He had an expensive camera. And he was working a festival in Northern California in July of 2017. And at that festival, his personal property was stolen. His wallet, his keys, his camera. He called me from the festival and told me he'd been ripped off and that, he couldn't even drive his work truck off of the venue site. And, you know, he asked me for help, and that was on a Wednesday in July, a few days before he was killed. And that he was going to go to this little city of Chico in Northern California and be with friends. And we were going to talk a bit. My wife and I were going to drive to the festival site, which is in up closer to Eureka, which is almost at the Oregon border. And we were going to get his truck, my wife and I, and then, you know, drive to Chico and pick him up and then come back to Ventura. And so we were talking over the phone. We had this plan. And my wife and I left Ventura. It's about a 12-hour or so drive from our home to Eureka, California, where his truck was. And we did it on the Saturday, would have been July 22nd. And when we finally did find his truck, we couldn't get it started. So we didn't have cell phone service, so we didn't know if we couldn't reach our son. But the next day on Sunday, we got the vehicle towed to a dealer, and then we headed towards back towards Ventura, and we tried to get in touch with our son to let him know we had to make new plans on the Sunday, the day he was killed. And a friend of his called us about noon, 1 o'clock, told us Tyler was fine, that Tyler was, he'd get the message to Tyler that we had trouble with the truck and that we would be in touch and we were going to have to make another trip from Ventura up to, all the way up to almost Oregon to get the truck, with which we would do in the next few days, and then drive back through the city of Chico, pick him up, and then head back to Ventura. And that was on Sunday, July 23rd. And in the afternoon, we had this conversation with this friend of his. So we didn't think much about it. And he told Tyler he was going to talk to our son, give him the update. And that night, our son was killed in an officer-involved shooting. And the story we got from the district attorney was that our son had broken into a building, a commercial building, to steal things. Things like, they were small things like food out of the break room, copier paper, staplers, things of that nature, was stealing things, putting them in a patio. And when he was out of the patio of this building, this was also at dark, between 10 and 11 at night. So when the security guard went to the building to investigate the alarm that allegedly my son had set off while allegedly burglarizing this building, the guard approached my son with his gun out. He had a 9mm, you know, pistol, and he had it pointed at my gun, my son. He came, the guard came out of the dark, unannounced, dressed in black, approached my son, gun out, and my son did try to knock the, it appears from the body worn camera that my son tried to knock the gun out of the guard's hands. And he used, he had picked up a small flower pot, and so the handle of the flower pot, it's hard to tell, but the DA told us the handle of the flower pot hit the officer's or the guard's left arm, but the gun was in the guard's right hand. So the guard fired away and shot my son through the chest, very close range, just a few inches away. Then my son stumbled or walked or ran or crawled, we don't know for sure, back into this building, went to the bathroom, tried to give himself first aid, was successful at giving himself first aid and to stop the bleeding from his chest. But he locked himself in the bathroom. And then the police came, it was the Chico Police Department, Chico, California. They came to this building and they tried to talk my son out of the building. They were unsuccessful at doing that. So the sergeant in charge rammed the door open and let a canine dog go in first to try to get my son to comply. And in the melee of the dog going in and my son being probably terrified by the dog, we really don't know. It was a small bathroom, about a 4 by 10 foot bathroom. And my son was in this bathroom with this German Shepherd off the leash, and he started flailing, my son did, and the officers came in and they tried to subdue my son, and allegedly my son was scratched one of the officers with a pen from an officer's shirt pocket and struck one of the officers with a piece of the toilet tank lid. And during that, and of course the dog was also attacking my son while this scrimmage or whatever was going on. And the officer, a sergeant in charge, got upset and pulled his gun out, shot my son through the throat at the Adam's apple, and then shot him in the back of the head, between the ears and the back of the head. And then about a minute later, the officers tased my son when he was laying on the floor. He got a 50,000 volt stun gun tasing. And then they pulled my son out of the bathroom, and of course, he was dead on the scene. So when I got the message, my son was killed Sunday night, very early Monday morning. I didn't get the call until Wednesday morning that my son was dead. The local coroner approached our house and told us that he was dead. And actually, my wife was actually on, I had picked up my son's truck in Eureka, California, and she was driving from Eureka to Chico. At the time, I was told in Ventura that our son was dead. So I had to call my wife and give her that horrible news that our son had been shot by officers in a burglary. And it just was like being hit by lightning. We just had no clue. Our son had no criminal history. He was self-employed. He was working. He was with friends. And Lawrence, in the music industry and arts industry, it's very common for the camaraderie amongst those workers to help each other out. And so we weren't really too worried about Tyler, and he didn't tell us he was scared or hungry or in danger. And then to find out that he was dead and killed by police officers in a burglary, it just didn't make any sense. So that's the background of the killing of our son. We did hire an attorney and related experts, and we filed an unlawful, use of force, wrongful death case against the department, the officers, the dog handler, the tasing officer who tasered our son, the guard who shot our son. So we have a rather complicated lawsuit. Nothing will bring our son back, but I just feel like it was an unnecessary use of force by the guard, unnecessary use of force by the police officers who had our son in a bathroom with no place to go, and he was wounded. And that I'm not conceding he was the burglar, Captain Hunter, but if he was, then he deserved his day in court. He didn't deserve, two bullets, a tasing, and to be attacked by a dog. He had no place to go. He was in a bathroom. And the officers had complete control of the situation of a wounded subject. And they're trained to know how to deal with people like my son in that situation. And just to shoot him like that at point blank range in the throat and in the back of the head and have the dog bite him after he'd been wounded just seemed horrifically violent to me and unnecessary. And that's where we are. We filed our lawsuit, and it's in a federal court, the Ninth District Federal Court here in California. And we're waiting to see if we're going to be allowed a trial or our case will be dismissed. The judge has it in his control right now.
Very good. Thank you for, sharing that very tragic story. I know it's probably very difficult to continue to relive that and to continue to talk about it. So thank you. I give you a lot of credit for being able to talk about it. Now, so obviously your son was confronted by this security guard who does not, I would presume, receive the same amount of training as a police officer, and I'm very surprised that he was armed. Now, from what I read, he was he's armed, and he had a college degree, so this wasn't some knucklehead kid. But his level of training, I'm sure, does not rise up to the levels that an officer would be trained as far as the escalation of the use of force and things like that. So he So that particular interaction, I think your son surprised him. Am I right in that? Your son, well, allegedly surprised him, or.
Well, this is a subject of debate. The district attorney says my son attacked the guard.
And he was wearing a body cam.
My,
The guard was wearing a body cam.
that's right. The guard had the body cam and the weapon out. It wasn't holstered. This is one of my arguments, and I have researched the rights of a guard in California and an armed guard in California. There's a 40-hour class, 40, that the guards take, and then they're allowed to carry a lethal weapon like that, like the pistol, just after a 40-hour class. And that's very skimpy training to be able to have lethal force on your hip. It is a violation of the state of California standard and practice for an armed guard to have the gun out. It's for defensive purposes only. It's not for offensive purposes. So when the guard, exited his vehicle, his guard car, whatever it is, sedan or whatever, and he walked towards the commercial building, He had his gun out of his holster, and that's a violation of state policy. If my son, for example, had exited the building and charged the guard, like ran at him with a knife or a stick or a gun, well, then the guard has the right to pull the gun and fire. He has that self-defense, armed guard, you know, protection. But to enter a building on an alarm, and I've tripped the alarm at my office accidentally several times in my career, where I entered a building, I forgot to shut the darn alarm off, or I didn't get to the pad fast enough to put the code in, and the police sometimes will show up and say, is everything okay, Mr. Rushing? You know, and I'm glad they do that, and I thank them, and I say, that's totally my fault. I didn't get to the pad and put the password in fast enough, so I apologize. And in this case, this one guard alone in the dark decided to get out of his car, pull his gun out, and go looking through the building for a potential reason for the alarm to go off. Maybe it was a homeless person, maybe it was a burglar, maybe it was a false alarm. But he confronted my son outside the building, which is kind of important because no one saw my son inside the building, Captain Hunter. There was no security camera film. There was no witnesses. The guard did not see my son in the building. The guard confronted, or my son confronted the guard outside the building, but the guard had his gun out and he had a tactical flashlight mounted onto his gun, which is also blinding. It's there for a reason, not only to illuminate, but it disorients anyone who gets those lights in their eyes. So my son, from his point of view, and I'm now speculating, he's on this patio outside the building, and someone's coming at him through the bushes of this patio, through the bushes, dressed in black, unannounced, gun out, and he's in a patio with very limited options of where to go. You know, he can flee and get shot in the back. He can surrender to the gunman, or he can try to defend himself and knock the gun, which is what I think he did. He tried to knock the gun out of the guard's hands and run. But unfortunately, my son wasn't successful in knocking the gun out of the guard's hands. So the guard got a shot off right in the chest. And my son was screaming and yelling as he tried to run away. And the guard wandered around, was still looking for the person he shot. And the real crime that the guard committed was not staying in his vehicle and calling the police. That's what they're trained to do. The phrase is called observe and report in California. If a guard goes around a building and certainly doesn't see any action, or even if he does see someone burglarizing, they're guards. They're just supposed to call the police and say, I'm watching a burglary in process, or I don't see anyone, but I'm not going to go on that patio, you know, and the guard is supposed to call the police, stay where they are, safe, and observe and report. But this guard, Captain Hunter, he had a degree in criminal justice. He was a member of the Chico Volunteer and Policing Department, which is volunteers that help the local PD. He had applied to be a correctional officer at the time. He was working as a security guard. So he was 23 years old. He was very clearly wanted a career in law enforcement. So I'm sure he felt emboldened to have that gun and to approach that false alarm or that alarm with the gun out. But because he did, it limited his options when he confronted Tyler. He had a baton, he had pepper spray, for example, but because he has his gun out, you know, he used his gun. And when he went onto the patio, he got, acting as a cop, not as a guard, you know, there it goes. That was the recipe for disaster of shooting my son. And that was the catalyst. The first shot was the catalyst that ended up really costing my son his life, because he got two more bullets from the Chico police sergeant, and then he got bitten and he got tased. So it was the guard that was the catalyst.
Right. So this guard, now you talked about that observe and the law, observe and report. Now that is something that is strictly for security guards, or is that something that is for any civilian? Does the California law make a distinction between that?
Yeah, that would be a guard, part of the standards and practices in the state training manual.
Okay.
For the private security industry. That's what it's really called, the security industry.
Okay. And so he should have received that as a part of his 40 hours training that I'm assuming that he passed.
Well, we assume that, correct.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So he confronts Tyler, he gets, things go awry from there. Now, how did Tyler end up inside of the building?
It appears that there was a sliding door open to this patio, and that we don't really know. The short answer is we don't really know. The guard thought that, and it's recorded, the guard thought that Tyler had run off through the bushes and run off. But actually, Tyler had gone into the building, we assume, through a sliding glass door that from the building to the patio, and that he had entered and gone into the ladies' bathroom, actually, which was a small bathroom. But we don't really know the answer to that question. If he crawled, if he ran, we just don't really know.
I understand. Now, I really want to talk about what said concerning the officers. In your mind, they pushed the envelope, right? Because they, as you said, had time on their side. They controlled the situation. Tyler's isolated in a bathroom, and you think that they should have taken more time? Is that what you're saying? Or,
well, one of my arguments, for example, would be, and one of the officers is on the recording on his body worn camera. First of all, they could have brought in a negotiating team. The sergeant in charge is not a negotiator. He's a SWAT sergeant. Even though he was talking to Tyler, obviously wasn't successful. There was no conversation going back and forth. It was just strictly the sergeant kept saying, come out, come out, come out. I don't know what was going through my son's mind, but I know he'd been wounded. He was losing blood. And I would just think any normal person would be scared and might be afraid that that person on the other side of the door was the person who shot him. There was just no way Tyler could be sure. Again, he's wounded. He's probably in shock. Certainly not. I call it temporary mental impairment. Tyler wasn't mentally ill, and there were no drugs in his system, as we found out later from the autopsy. So he wasn't drunk, he wasn't on drugs, he wasn't mentally ill, but he had been wounded severely, and he didn't come out. For whatever reason, he was scared, I guess, to come out. It's a guess. So I think the sergeant, number one, should have brought in a negotiating team, which he did not do. Number two, and he could have. The Chico Police Department does have a negotiating team, but he chose not to call them. Number two, I believe that when he ran the door open and let a dog, the canine dog, go in, and I think you heard the craziness of the dog barking and the scene, the sergeant lost control, really, when the dog started barking and whining, was anxious to bite someone. Because that's how the dogs are trained. And you hear the canine handler yell, pocken, pocken, pocken. That's German for bite, bite, bite. So you have the sergeant saying, come on out, come on out, buddy. Everything will be fine. And then you have the canine handler say, if, you know, I'm going to send my dog in and my dog will bite you. So you've got one officer saying, come on out, buddy. Everything will be okay. And then you have another officer saying, my dog will bite you. And the dog was barking and whining and crying so loud that the officers kept having to shush the dog so they could speak to each other. So the dog, that canine, which is trained, as you know, to get compliance or bite somebody, was very anxious to go into action. And when they ran that door open, the dog was sent in first off the leash. The dog was not held on the leash by the canine. So you've got a German Shepherd getting behind the door where my son was. The only place to hide in the bathroom was behind the door to protect himself. I think my son was scared to death. He was behind the door, the only protection he had. And that dog was trying to get to him behind that door. Eventually, the officers pulled, got a hold of Tyler's arms, pulled him from behind the door. And that dog did bite him severely on the leg, as well as from the thighs down. So the dog was off the leash, which is also a violation of canine protocol. The dog should have been on the leash so the officer could pull the dog off of Tyler. But the canine officer did not do that. That created further confusion. So Tyler started flailing. So I believe they should have retreated. If I'm not a cop and I don't know the protocol, but I believe they should have, if that dog had been on the leash and they realized Tyler might have been non-compliant, they could have just stepped back out of the bathroom for a few moments and continued to talk to Tyler, or just let the dog do its thing. Let the dog bring Tyler into compliance. But the officers went in, instead of using pepper spray, for example, they could have pepper sprayed Tyler in his eyes. He'd already been shot through the chest. So if he had been pepper sprayed, you know, he couldn't have seen and he couldn't have, you know, breathed. He couldn't have taken a breath with that pepper spray. So, or they could have used a baton and just whacked Tyler over the head. But no, you know, they grapple with him. The dog had him low. The officers had him high. There was a struggle. I say it was just, Tyler was just acting in self-defense over the dog and these people, these two officers attacking him. And the sergeant got angry. He lost his cool, lost his temper when Tyler scratched him. And he took a step back and the sergeant pulled his gun out. And as you know, he pressed the pistol against his throat, fired. And then that scene on the body worn camera, but the last shot in the back of Tyler's head, I think it disappeared. I think it was deleted, the images of the sergeant shooting my son at point blank range in the back of his head, because that would be show the officers in a very unfavorable light for shooting my son in the back of the head. So that image was deleted and it's not available to us. And then my son was tasered. So I think there was a lot of unnecessary use of force. I think all they really need to do was wait, maybe till he passed out. There was no hurry. There were no hostages. There was nobody in danger, including the officers. So they put themselves in danger when they broke in. So then to blame Tyler is, you can't have it both ways, is what I'm saying, Captain Hunter. They either let him die from blood loss and they protect themselves. But once they broke in, to blame Tyler for them having to shoot him, doesn't make any sense. They went in to rescue him and get him medical attention, and then they end up shooting him twice, biting him and getting tased. That's not what I call a rescue. That's what I call an attack. And so that's my argument and that's my case.
Yeah, well, I think you've painted a very vivid case, that one that I think that people may want to get behind and very likely sympathize with, that, you know, you're right. Turning it into a going from a rescue into, you know, unfortunately, his demise. What particularly You mentioned the DA's report, which you sent to me and I did read. What, I mean, you don't have to go through the whole thing, but just give us maybe three things that you think that that were completely incorrect in the DA's report, and that you say if you go to court, you can prove that they lied. Give us three things that were incorrect, unfactual in his report.
Well, one of the initial arguments that I think the public should know, one of the reasons I want to talk to you and get the word out to the public, is that people in my position and other families that have lost loved ones in officer-involved shootings need to realize that the report done by the district attorney is not done under penalty of perjury. And I'm going to repeat that. The report that I sent you and the report that are done by, whether it's called a prosecuting attorney or a district attorney, those are not done under penalty of perjury. Those are opinions that are created and written by a prosecuting attorney or a district attorney to decide if criminal charges will be filed against the officers. So it's an opinion. It's not done under, for example, under oath. The DA and the prosecuting attorneys don't have to be accurate. They can pick the facts they want to pick. They can omit facts they want to omit. They can speculate wherever there's a question, like you and I have been talking. You know, we're speculating on some things that happened. But in the DA's report, for example, let's talk about Tyler's criminal history. One of the things that annoyed me in that report, the district attorney used the phrase, I don't have it in front, it's either minor or moderate criminal history, that Tyler Rushing had a minor or moderate criminal history. That sounds to the average reader like, oh, this guy had a criminal history of some sort. He had a criminal history. Lawrence, Tyler had one traffic citation in 2011. That was his criminal history, a traffic citation in 2011. He was killed in 2017. I've had three traffic citations since 2011. My son had one. The district attorney characterized my son as a moderate criminal with a moderate criminal history. To me, that's a blatant lie. And maybe lie is too strong a word, but it's certainly misleading and inaccurate. Another thing he did, which particularly upset me, is his investigators spoke with homeless people, and they cited two homeless people in the report that indicated Tyler was high or that Tyler had wanted to get high. When Tyler interacted with these homeless people on Sunday afternoon, and again, he was killed Sunday evening, they didn't identify who those homeless people were. But in my research, I found out who they were through my own legwork going to Chico and talking to, with the help of my private investigator and other people, we found the homeless people that are quoted in this district attorney report. And we got a completely different story from the homeless people, that than what the district attorney wrote, a completely different story about Tyler. And not only that, one of the homeless people that the DA referenced in his report also was a convicted felon within the same county that Tyler was killed. He was a convicted felon. It had been about 20 years, but the homeless person had been arrested in the late 90s for molesting children and for attempted murder of his spouse.
God. Wow.
And this homeless person, who the DA cited as being a well-known local homeless person, And it's quoted in a DA report regarding the killing of my son. Turns out that he had a criminal, felony criminal record within that county and had pled guilty to, they reduced the charges to the they dropped the attempted murder and it was the child molestation. He pled guilty to that. So he did serve time. And then that felon, convicted felon, was cited in the DA's report as being a knowledgeable person to opine about the mental condition of my son. Now, I think the average reader, knowing that DA investigators approaching a convicted felon are going to have some influence over that. So I'm saying it was a tainted investigation by the DA when they go to somebody that they had already has a felony record within their jurisdiction. I don't think that homeless person is going to say anything to the officers that would be contradictory to what the officers are looking for, which is vilifying my son and making derogatory comments about my son. And it's not even, and frankly, it's not even 100% sure that the homeless people that are cited in the DA's report were even talking to my son. There was no witnesses, there's no body cam, there's no recording. And yet the DA puts in the report exonerating the officers that well-known homeless people had spoken with Tyler Rushing the day he was killed, and that Tyler Rushing was high on drugs and wanted to get higher. And I found that to be absolutely untrue. And I think the DA should have kind of mentioned to Mr. and Mrs. Rushing, my wife and I, that, oh, by the way, this homeless person is a convicted felon within this county. That would have been something that I think should have been included in the report. Or you don't put the comments at all, Lawrence, is what I'm saying. Those comments should not have been in there because they're vilifying and they're derogatory, and they're coming from somebody under the control of the DA, scared to death of the DA. So it's just obscene. Another omission that the DA did in his report. Again, he's allowed to make these omissions because they're not done under penalty of perjury. Another omission is the sergeant that shot my son. His last name is Ruppel, R-U-P-P-E-L. And Sergeant Ruppel shot my son through the throat and the back of the head on July 23rd of 2017. 17 days later, approximately August 14th or 15th, Sergeant Ruppel was recorded strangling a young Native American man, 24-year-old man, in the back of Sergeant Ruppel's police car by a fellow officer. The young man, the suspect, the arrestee, was seat belted, and he was handcuffed behind his back in the back of the car, and Sergeant Ruppel got upset about something and reached into the back of the police car and put his forefinger and his thumb in the shape of a C and put it around the throat of this 24-year-old and lifted him up in the back of his car to the headliner. The headliner saved this young man from being maybe choked to death or certainly being injured by Sergeant Ruppel. And just 17 days earlier, Sergeant Ruppel was the officer that put two bullets through my son. The fact that Sergeant Ruppel then was the subject of an internal affairs investigation was omitted by the DA. I found out later on in the year when Sergeant Ruppel had charges filed against him for the strangling. There was a trial in October. And I went to the trial because I wanted to hear about this Sergeant Ruppel. I didn't know him. I didn't know anything about him. But I knew he had charges filed by his own department or by this DA for strangling this young man. In that trial, again, this was just 17 days after he shot my son. And you know from your experience that most officers, when they're involved in an officer-involved shooting, there's a period of time where they're on administrative leave.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. Why was he not on that? Why was he not on some type of admin? We put him on desk duty, admin leave or admin of duty. Yeah. Why was he not there?
No answer. The DA had no answer for that. He had no answer for that question. Why wasn't Sergeant Ruppel on administrative duty while the investigation of the killing of Tyler Rushing was being done? He wasn't. He shot Tyler Sunday night. He worked his regular shift Monday. And he did not have one hour off after putting two bullets through my son. Sergeant Ruppel took no, and he bragged about it in court. That was the thing. I'm sitting in court and I'm seeing the man who put two bullets through my son up on the stand. And he was asked by the DA, were you influenced at all by this event that you were involved in, this tragic killing a few days before you strangled, this young arrestee? Were you under the influence, do you feel, of some kind of psychological pressure over this killing? And Sergeant Ruppel testified that not only was he not under any traumatic feelings at the time, but that he worked his next shift. He was actually proud that he had no time off after shooting my son. And I was sitting in the court, and I was just shocked that Sergeant Ruppel not only had no time off, he was bragging that he had no time off when he's on trial for strangling another suspect just 17 days after killing my son. And that was not even mentioned in the report that Sergeant Ruppel was currently under an internal affairs investigation for this strangling, which occurred 17 days. So you see what I'm saying? The omissions. And in my deposition, when I was deposed by the attorneys for the police department, I brought this out, that I found out these facts by accident and by research, that the district attorney had cited a convicted felon. The district attorney was investigating the officer that shot my son, but those facts were not even mentioned. And a blatant lie was the police chief had released to the media that Officer Ruppel had been was on administrative leave, when in fact he wasn't. And the mayor of the city posted to his Facebook page that this Sergeant Ruppel, whose life was almost taken by the flailing suspect, is on administrative leave. Those kinds of press releases were made by the mayor of this town and by the police chief, and they were both false. Absolute falsehood. And yet they end up in the DA's report. The DA also implied that my son was on drugs. He had seven, I'm not a chemist, but he had 7 nanograms of THC marijuana in his tissue at the time he was killed, according to the Butte County coroner. The lab work by the Butte County coroner. Remember, the Butte County coroner works for the county, for the DA. He works for the DA. I was able to get my son re-autopsied. It was quite a battle to get his body released from Butte County. I had my buddy, it was horrible because it was only 14 days after my son was killed. I'm trying to pull my head together and make a strategy based on my outrage over the way my son was killed. But I got his body transferred to a pathologist in Pasadena, California, actually La Cañada, California. And in the second autopsy, we found some concerning some discrepancies between the first autopsy regarding the wound to the back of my son's head. It had been altered in some way by the first pathologist, the Butte County pathologist, so that concerned me. And then also the lab work from the private autopsy showed no drugs whatsoever in my son's system. And the DA knew that because my son was autopsied 14 days, you know, after the first autopsy, I had him re-autopsied. So the DA knew that there's at least a conflict between the lab results of the first autopsy and the lab results of the second autopsy. But I didn't believe anything that came out of the Butte County Coroner's Office. So I paid to have my son moved and privately, and we're talking a lot of money, and not to mention the emotional stress that I was going under, and my wife and I, at the loss of our only son. But I wanted answers. So, and I got the answers. The wounds had been altered and there were no drugs in my blood system, my son's blood at all. Not one bit, not even marijuana was in his system. Yet the DA and the pathologist from Butte County insist that my son had some sort of allergic reaction to the marijuana, which caused him to flail and be so violent against the police officers who were trying to save him and get him a rescue, Captain Hunter. That's the story. So I'm giving you the highlights.
Right, right.
of my concern.
I did find it very troubling when I read the report, and the DA was saying something along the lines of what you're saying, that even though there was no or minimal or whatever his phrase was, that he said that no drugs found, it's highly likely that we haven't found what he was on, so we couldn't test for it, or something along those lines, he said. So yeah. I'm like, why would you write this? You're supposed to be finding fact, not speculating. So at that point, I will concede that I think that the DA kind of overstepped his bounds there, speculating that he must have been, basically he was saying he must have been high on something, we just don't know what it was, even though we couldn't find it. And that's that's crazy. That's crazy.
And using that to justify a killing, you know, it's not just a speculation. I mean, he's using that to say at the end of, as you know, and you've got the report, to say, you know, the officers acted in a reasonable manner, something to that effect. You know the legal phrase.
Right.
And basically the killing's justified and the officer, no charges will be filed. And so I've done, obviously we can't cover everything, but you see my point of view. When I expected that report would be at least accurate, you know, and at least transparent, and virtually any place the DA could, transparency would show the officers in an unfavorable light, to use a legal phrase. He did. He would take the, you know, he would make show my son in an unfavorable light and do all he could to protect the officers. And if you do read that report is not done under penalty of perjury. The DA is allowed to speculate. He's allowed to omit. He's allowed to include whatever he wants. And Captain Hunter, when I never really talked to the DA about the report, but in my deposition, which lasted 7 hours, by the way, even though I didn't kill anybody and I'm not on trial, the defense deposed me for 7 hours about my son and about my wife and I and about our mental health and about our lifestyle. The attorney, 7 hours they had us in a deposition, three for my wife and seven for me.
Wow.
That's how deep they were digging, the police, the defense, to find something to justify their unnecessary use of force. That's what it comes down to. I say this guard was a wannabe cop for the reasons I mentioned. And I say this officer, Ruppel, was a rogue cop for the same reasons I mentioned. And by the way, he retired, Officer Ruppel, which I don't know if I told you, during this, between the time he strangled the Native American young man and the time of the trial, which was in October 2018, he retired at the end of 2017. Officer Ruppel retired. So he can avoid being fired because he retired, but he could not avoid the, they were only misdemeanor charges, very low level charges, but at least there were charges filed against him for strangling the Native American boy.
He was acquitted of that though, right? I thought you sent me an article saying he was acquitted from that.
Yeah. He got acquitted, and it was a unanimous acquittal as well. So it was,
and it's on video. You sent me a picture. I don't understand. This is. I wasn't on the jury, but I don't understand that.
Well, let me say something about that, about Mr. And then I'll let you finish your point because I'm doing too much talking. But I went to day one of the trial, of the strangling trial. There was no trial regarding the killing of my son, but the strangling trial was of interest to me because it was Sergeant Ruppel. So I went day one, and I sat through all the jury selection, and this is something you'll find interesting. That's done in the courtroom in public, the jury selection. And of the 12 jurors selected, seven of them were either former police officers or had family members that were police officers, seven of the 12. The other five all testified that they felt police officers were honest, and they felt that, you know, that officers should be protected and had nothing but good things to say. And about a half a dozen jurors, potential jurors, who in court stated that they had problems with police officers in the past. They felt police officers tended to be bullies or used unnecessary force. All of those potential jurors were dismissed by both sides, which is interesting. Both sides dismissed any juror, potential juror, who said anything negative about the police. And on top of that, the eventual jury foreman testified that he personally knew Sergeant Ruppel and had coffee with Sergeant Ruppel and thought Sergeant Ruppel was a very fine young man. And he ended up being not only selected for the jury, but was the foreman of the jury. So I'm a real estate broker. I'm no cop. I'm no attorney. I'm sitting there listening to this jury. I have done jury duty. So I'm sitting there listening to these jurors being selected, and they're all pro-police jurors. And I told my, I was there with a friend, and I told my friend, I said, this is a publicity stunt. These attorneys have filed misdemeanor charges against Sergeant Ruppel, who's retired, because they just want to get rid of the guy, but they want to look like they're tough on cops. So they're going to have this little show trial. They're going to acquit him, and then all will be well. And then the DA can say, I'm tough against bad cops. See, I filed charges against Sergeant Ruppel for strangling a kid, but the jury didn't see it my way. And that's exactly what happened, Lawrence. It was completely controlled by this DA in this very small county of 200,000 people.
Wow, that's really... really something. Wow. I don't even know what to say to that.
It's just an observation. That's why I appreciate you letting me be on the show, because it's almost, because that's what this DA wants. I mean, he controls a small county, and he knows there's nobody really watching. I can also add that, you know, like I said, I found most of the facts out and the discrepancies in his report by accident, by digging, by shoe leather, by private investigator. And that's not how a family should have to hear about the people who killed their son. The DA should be honest, should be transparent, you know, good or bad. This is the story. But that's not what happens. And that's not what happened here.
I'm really sorry about that. I'm truly sorry about how you've been treated and the system that really did not seem to do right by you. So obviously, as we mentioned before, that none of this, what you're doing now and the federal lawsuit that you have filed is going to bring your son back. What is it that you're hoping to, that is accomplished going forward for law enforcement, for yourself, for justice for your son? What is it that you're hoping for?
Well, selfishly, I would like to prevail in the lawsuit. I know it sounds terrible, but I would love to have a humongous, you know, monetary charge against the department. I mean, I'd like to get a verdict with a tremendous cash award that would leave a real impression upon this DA and on this county and on the police chief and on that police force that they can't be trigger happy. They got to keep those guns in the holster. They just can't blow people away. And I would take that money and I would set up a foundation. I don't need the money. I don't need money from my son's death to live. I'm successful. My wife and I are successful. We were not planning to live off our children, to put it mildly, or the death of our children. We have a daughter now. But I would love to get a huge monetary award and set up a foundation and do something that would increase the ability for people that are poor, people that can't afford an attorney, that have lost loved ones in officer-involved shootings, to be able to get proper legal counsel, psychological counsel, and mentoring, so they can assess if they've got a case. There is no organization like that in the United States. There is no place for people to go that are poor, that maybe people have mental illness or, you know, they're homeless and or whatever, and they get killed by a police officer. I want the families to have a resource to go, someplace that they can call and get some advice and some direction, because what I have found out in my 31 months of study that type of organization doesn't exist. You know, you've heard of Black Lives Matter, ACLU, NAACP, Nicole, for example, Leanna Perez's organization. They don't reach out to people who have lost loved ones, to families who have lost loved ones to in-officer involved shootings. That organization doesn't exist. So that would be my goal. If I'm going to do it anyway, whether we win or lose, that is my goal, is I'm going to set up with other families that I've been in touch with, and I've talked to maybe 10 families that have lost loved ones in suspicious circumstances to police officers and non-transparent officer-involved shootings. And we're going to form some kind of a national referral organization, a 501c4 organization. We're going to raise money. We're going to lobby politicians. We're going to support politicians that will back the accountability and the transparency that's needed in these officer-involved shootings. That's my goal.
That certainly is a lofty goal, and I wish you much success with that going forward. If anyone wants to review any of this type of stuff, I know I had to Google. Well, you sent me a lot of links online. I even did some Google searches for the newspaper clippings and articles. Do you have a website, or have you set up anything like that where people can go and review the information concerning your son or anything like that?
No, I haven't organized quite like that. I've invited people to just email me at my email address. And I'm on Facebook, you know, Scott Rushing. It's got a picture of my son on it. I post a lot on Facebook. Anything I think is of interest regarding officer-involved shootings, I will post it. And I have a set of friends, a couple, not a lot, maybe 200. and they can share it with their friends. If I feel a shooting is bogus, if I feel the shooting, you know, was excessive use of force, body worn cameras, images are being held back, anything that to me doesn't pass the smell test, I post that on Facebook and share it with my friends. But if anybody wants to contact me directly, they can just email me. I think you have my email address, but I'll give it to you now. So if people are listening to this, it's the word broker, B-R-O-K-E-R. I'm a real estate broker. My email address is broker at my name, scottrushing.com. That's S-C-O-T-T-R-U-S-H-I-N-G, like rushing around, scottrushing.com. And you can also, of course, Google Tyler Rushing and frankly, see a horrible video of a young man who should be alive today being killed. And, you know, they escalated it, Kevin. They meaning the guard, he violated guard rules. The Chico PD escalated what was supposed to be a medical rescue into an attack of just a suspect. You know, he wasn't convicted of anything. He was a suspect, and he got treated like he was just worse than a wild animal. You know, wild animals get tranquilizer darts. You know, my son got bullets and bitten and choked and tased. I mean, you tell me, is that a rescue or is that an attack?
Well, it certainly did not turn out to be a rescue. That's for sure. And I do think, I think that patience really should rule the day when it comes to law enforcement. I think you raised some really good points. As far as there being, no rush, there was no hostage situation. You know, he's in a confined space. The officers are. You watch other officers on their video body cams. They're doing a search of the perimeter inside the building, as well, making sure there's no one else there and there's no object for ambush, no or anything like that. And as long as you've got them isolated, you know, what's the rush? So I think that that's actually very valid on your part. Very valid.
Well, and it's not just my opinion. I can tell you and the listeners, your listeners, and I hope there's thousands of them. And I
hope there's thousands of them
and
too.
I hope I do. I hope that I'm contributing to your show. And, I think it helps the social media to get this word out. I mean, very few people, fortunately, will suffer what I've suffered. I mean, it's very rare to lose a child to an officer-involved shooting, fortunately, but it does happen. And when it does, it's like getting hit by lightning. It's a shock in so many ways.
Right.
That I think shows like yours, it's going to start at least getting the word out. So social media is powerful. People will start to listen. They don't have to believe me. I hope they will. But they can look for themselves and see, and if they want to contact me and talk about it, I have had some horrible people call me and tell me my son was a POS. I think you can figure out what POS means. I've had actually people tell me that was what my son was, and there's one less POS for the police to deal with. That kind of hate you get from, you know, unfortunately. The public, but of course I don't respond to any of those types of things. And I don't, and what I'm saying is thought out. I'm not a bomb thrower. You don't hear me say FTP. I think you know what that means.
Right.
You do not hear me saying that, right. Or I don't go there. I think that's counterproductive to be a bomb thrower and to be profane. Right. Nevertheless, I'm still angry. I have trouble sleeping. I have trouble, realizing I'll never see my son again, that he left my home. Fortunately, the last thing I said to him before he went to this festival was, I love you. And he said, love you too, you know? So the last words were those. And And that's it. You know, other than a few phone calls that we had, that he was fine and we were talking. The next time I saw him, he was being pulled out of a refrigerator in Butte County, being pulled out of a refrigerator and with a hole in his throat, chest. And frankly, here's another point I wanted to make. The district attorney initially told me that my son was shot three times, the chest, the throat, and in the face. Like he was, like if you and I were going to have a fight, normally we'd be facing each other. I mean, we can't really have a fight if, you know, well, like we're back to back or something. And then we found out, you know, when I looked at the body and my pathologist, that the shot in my son's head was actually not through his mouth. It came from the back of his head, and the bullet exited his jaw. So I was given misinformation from the get-go, from this DA. Just immediately started misleading me and my wife. And we're already, you know, torn up emotionally. And then to have this fellow mislead us, that's just another crime. It's an ethical crime, I think. I mean, I can't, he doesn't have to be honest with me, and he wasn't. It's not illegal, it's just unethical. But don't you think that when an officer, an elected official like a DA, is talking to a family member, they should do all they can to be accurate and ethical? Isn't that fair to request that?
I definitely think so. I definitely think there's some ethics that should go that position. You know, that's very surprising. Very surprising to hear that kind of stuff. I'm very sorry. I'm very, very sorry for you having to have endured all of that. That's really, really terrible. But I do.
Well, unfortunately, I'm not the only one. And and like I said, that's my goal is to. I can't bring my son back, but I have. I'm 67. I'm. I wish I were 55, but I'm 67, and for the rest of my life, I'm going to try to create this blanket organization. I haven't really thought it out too much. These ideas come to me when I can't sleep at night, frankly, of how to pull all these disparate facts together from across the country, whether it's like the Tamir Rice shooting. And I wanted to say something about the Tamir Rice shooting in Baltimore. You're from Connecticut, not too far from Baltimore, but the Tamir Rice case interests me because the Rice family hired an expert witness by the name of Roger Clark, who ripped apart the officer who used unnecessary force in killing 12-year-old Tamir Rice. You know, for playing with the plastic pistol in a park, which I used to do all the time when I was a kid. I had cowboy pistols, you know, Lone Ranger, that kind of thing. And poor little Tamir got blown away by this police officer. The expert witness in that case is my expert witness in my case. It's the same. I didn't know that until recently, that my police expert, Roger Clark, is the same one. Now, unfortunately, the officers were not charged in the killing of Tamir Rice, as I'm sure you're aware. But Roger Clark has reviewed the images that you saw, Captain Hunter, and he was outraged at the way the Chico Police Department treated my son. He was absolutely outraged. Right. And he's an expert. He's a nationwide expert. I'm not.
Right.
He is.
Right, right. I understand. I definitely understand. Yeah. The Tamir Rice was very tragic and troubling for many persons. And I think I brought this up when we first started the conversation. There's a problem when people think that these situations are isolated to, you know, particular communities. And Tamir Rice was in Cleveland, and it was just
it was Baltimore. I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, there's plenty to go around. But you know, when people think this happens in no community, in isolated communities, I have a saying that I've been saying on the show for since I started is, you know, if they come for you, if they come for me in the morning, they'll come for you in the evening, right? So if you're watching all this stuff going on, and no matter what it is, right? If it's you know, sexual assault victims, I mean, sooner or later, that same thing is going to happen to you. So we have an obligation to make sure that we're upfront, that we're honest, and that we stop any kind of tragedy before it happens. And, you know, just because people have this mindset that it's them over there, it's them over there, it's them over there. As we record this, we're dealing with this coronavirus, and people think, okay, that was just something that happens in China, it just happened in Italy, it just happens over there, or those people on that boat over there. But sooner or later, it's going to come to your shores and come to your front door. So we have an obligation to do something about it. And so I hope that people who are listening to this will understand that fact, and we should sit on juries and not be so pro police that we're you know, making disastrous mistakes and letting these people out on the street. There's some people who just don't have the temperament to be police officers. There's some chiefs of police who just don't have it. There's some DAs who don't have it, and we ought to praise those who do have it, who have that gumption, that gall, and that audacity to do the right thing, to stand up for the right reason, and for truth and honesty and all that kind of stuff. But those people who are a stain on the criminal justice system should be immediately removed. And I really wish you the best of success. I'm so sorry that you're dealing with this. And I thank you for coming on Captain Hunter's podcast and sharing your story. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you're very welcome. It's a sad story, but if anybody listens to this, they're not alone. I mean, there's approximately 1,000 people killed by officers every year in the country, and it's kind of a hidden epidemic. And all the people that happen, they just don't know where to go and what to do. So hopefully through this show, you know, maybe we can somehow coalesce, you know, and fight for transparency and ethical, just doing the right thing, just doing what's right.
I agree. Well, thank you so much. I appreciate your time.